Welcome to page 14. We're here at the Jesse tree page, and all that's on the page is a tree. I know it looks dismal. It's a dead tree, as a matter of fact, because this comes from Isaiah 11:1, this prophecy that out of the stump of Jesse will come the Savior. And this is an Advent tradition that we remember the lineage of Jesse. We remember the lineage of the whole Old Testament, the bloodline from Adam and Eve to Jesus. Just like we're talking about in the Gospel of Matthew, the Jesse tree is kind of a applying Old Testament prophecies and remembering the family tree of Jesus in preparation for Christmas tradition. That's really what it all is. So I included this page not because I'm actually going to walk you through it, but because I think it's a cool thing to do as you're kind of approaching understanding Jesus and saying, okay, we're gonna get into his life, we're gonna get into his details, and so much of his life and details are going to be wrapped up in Old Testament life and details. If you flip through these pages, you're gonna see that there's a line that goes down the middle of the page, and half of it is New Testament, and half of it is why did Jesus do this? Oh, because in the Old Testament, this is what was happening. Okay, so this Jesse tree is just a moment for you to pause, and if you want, I just think it's a fun activity to draw little ornaments on this tree, okay, just like you do in the normal Jesse tree tradition, and remember the stories of the ancestors of Jesus that came before him. Okay, it's kind of like a quiz yourself. Go through Matthew's genealogy, on page 12, and circle the names of the people, and then, just to cement it in your memory, draw a little ornament for each person. This is just to prepare you, to familiarize you. If it's been a minute since you've been in the Old Testament or taken the Old Testament course, here you are, remembering and kind of feeling like you understand it all again. Okay, so that's page 14, and then I'm going to move on to page 15 because page 14, I set you free to do it by yourself. Page 15 is we got to talk about kind of the world at the time of Jesus to understand, to put in context the story of Jesus. So there's a couple of different things we're going to talk about. The first is recent history. The second is the religion of Judaism, and the religious groups within there. So first, world history. If you've taken the Old Testament course, sorry, I know I keep mentioning it. It's just that I don't want to repeat myself. If you've already taken it, I don't want you to be like, I already know all this, Monica. So just to kind of briefly summarize, the Maccabean Revolt period, which is in the book of 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees in the Old Testament, that happened in 166 BC. Okay, so they had independence from Greece. The state of Judea had independence from Greece from 166 to 63 BC. Jesus comes right around the turn of the century, right around 0 AD. Okay, more like 6 BC. We'll talk about that in a minute. But it's kind of recent history that for 100 years, Judea was, free. There are old men at the time of Jesus who still remember that freedom. Okay, in 63 BC, General Pompey of the Roman Empire conquered Jerusalem, and he was Rome took over Greece. So at the time of Jesus, Rome is occupying Judea, and a lot of people think that the Messiah who's coming is coming to overthrow them from Rome, just like Judas Maccabees overthrew them from Greece about, 100 years earlier. We know that Jesus doesn't come to do that, and so it's a bit of a surprise. Now, let's talk a little bit about this 166 to 63 BC, this 100-year time period of independence. Because the Judeans, they ruled themselves in the middle of Greece. Greece was, a huge empire, and right in the middle is this tiny little, state of their own, Judea, that ruled themselves. And what would make sense, I guess, if you're thinking who would be king of Judea, would be the guy in the bloodline who's supposed to be the king, David and Solomon's son, right? But they didn't do that, okay? The family of Judas Maccabees, he's got five brothers, he's got one father named Mattathias, and then his brothers, they're collectively called the Hasmoneans, okay? They're not called the Maccabees, technically, they're called the Hasmoneans. And the Hasmoneans, when they ruled, each of the brothers kind of took a turn ruling, they did not take the opportunity that they had to put the rightful king on the throne. There was a rightful king somewhere. If you flip back to page 12 and you see the Matthew's genealogy, you'll notice that you don't recognize a bunch of these names in the last paragraph because they're undercover. They're these kings that should have been on the throne, but the Maccabee, sorry, it's not the Maccabees, it's the Hasmoneans, Judas Maccabees and his brothers, they ruled instead. Okay? You notice that they're not in the bloodline. They're not supposed to be on the throne. They did amazing work of overthrowing and leading this revolution, and they should have said, all right, time to put you on the throne, but they didn't. Okay, so the Hasmoneans took on the kingship and the priesthood. The priesthood is supposed to go to the Levites who come from the line of Aaron, And the kingship is supposed to go to the line of David, but it wasn't theirs. It left bitterness and then this religious gap, because the priesthood especially is supposed to be the sacred thing. It's not supposed to be like elected. Rome is not supposed to have their fingers in it. The Hasmonean people, the Hasmonean dynasty, those kings, Judas Maccabeus and his brothers and their descendants, they made like alliances and pacts with Greece and with Rome in order that they stayed in power. And this really left a lot of distrust. So that'll lead to the emergence of the Pharisees and the Sadducees that we'll see a little bit further down the page. But let's talk for a minute, continuing on our line of kings. We'll talk about Herod the Great. Herod the Great is the one who murdered the holy innocents. He was there at the time of Jesus. He's the one who met the Magi. He ruled from 37 to 4 BC. Okay. 37 BC to 4 BC. And he was not a Davidic king either. He was put there by Rome, but he is interestingly a descendant of Esau. Remember Esau? Esau, the hairy red twin of Jacob, the older brother who Jacob stole the bloodline from. Here his line is back again to punish. And he married a Hasmonean wife to legitimize his kingship, but he is not like supposed to be there. So nobody trusts him. So he's very paranoid. He was paranoid about people taking over his reign. He was paranoid that there would be another king trying to rise up against him. He was put in power by Rome. And he did a lot of good things. I mean, some good things. He rebuilt some of Jerusalem. He expanded the pool of Siloam to be like a big old Olympic-sized pool. He added the porch of Solomon to the temple. He probably died of colon cancer, interestingly, we know. But he also ordered lots of mass killings. He had his wife and his mother-in-law killed because he thought they were trying to overthrow him. He had some of his sons killed. I guess a historian wrote jokingly, like, it was actually safer to be the pig of Herod rather than the son of Herod, because Herod didn't eat pigs because, you know, he's a Jew, but he doesn't. He can kill his own sons. So anyways, the fact that the holy innocents were killed because he hears that possibly there's a baby king who might be overthrowing him, that makes complete sense. That's right in track with what he'd do. Order a mass killing. Make sure that nobody ever threatens my power. So the Herod that Jesus goes to at the end of his life and is tried by, that's not Herod the Great. That's Herod the Great's son. He's got three sons. His sons, let me just try to say these names right, Archelaus, Philip, and Antipas. And the three of them were left, you know, alive by their father, and they made their way to Rome to ask for authority, and Caesar Augustus split the territory between them, okay? So Herod Antipas is the one that we know as the guy who, you know, Jesus went to him, and he was like, work a miracle, and he and Pontius Pilate kind of traded Jesus back and forth on the morning of Jesus' death. That's Herod Antipas. He ruled Galilee. Jesus ministered mostly in Galilee, so he kind of knew this guy a little bit. Herod Antipas was also the one who John the Baptist said your wife and your marriage is illegal, so he had him killed. Technically his wife had him killed, but yes, he was the one to condemn Jesus. Okay. Herod Archelaus, I can't say that first one. He ruled down near Bethlehem, and he is the one who Mary and Joseph did not feel safe enough probably to settle in Bethlehem. They went back up to Galilee to Nazareth because he was kind of a wicked ruler. Okay. Now, one last thing to note just here as we're talking about like recent history is that the Romans established a road system and a postal system that made it possible for word to travel. Okay. So this is a great time to bring the church in, even if you're like, why? Why now? Now is the fullness of time. Now is when God decides to send Jesus. It's like, this is the first time in history up to this point where they actually are united and able to communicate and travel and send things. And so this is, you know, you can just see this might be a good reason why now. Anyway, let's talk about the religion of the Jews at this point, okay? Because it's gotten a little bit messy and there's these different groups going on. Ultimately, the thing to say is that there is no normative point of view for the Jews. We had a lot of different sects going on at this time with different viewpoints, different agreements, different parties, okay? So this is why choosing a Jewish canon of the Old Testament, that's not possible. The whole thing about the 73 books versus the 66 books of the Bible comes back to choosing the Jewish canon. The early church and then the Catholic Church in 382 AD with the Council of Rome chose the canon, and they chose from the Old Testament seven books that the Protestant Reformation would later reject. But they didn't choose them based on the Jewish canon, because there was no the Jewish canon. There was this sect of Judaism's canon and that sect of Judaism's canon. It was all messy. So they just picked the books that they picked and they ran with it. Martin Luther in, you know, the Protestant Reformation, he didn't just hand pick these books and throw them out. He returned to a different Jewish canon and said, we should be following this one instead, against the authority of the church, against 1500 years of church practice, tradition, authority. So in one sense, he did throw it out, but he chose a different Jewish canon. But it's not like the Catholic Church didn't choose a Jewish canon. There was just multiple ones to choose from. They didn't agree on which canon of the Old Testament. Remember, this is not like a one book, you know. The Old Testament was a series of scrolls that was kept in different places and passed around, you know. So anyways, it was a mess. This is called Second Temple Judaism, by the way, because they're working out of the Second Temple. They rebuilt the First Temple after it was destroyed during the exile, and the Book of Ezra and Nehemiah, that's rebuilding the temple. The Book of Maccabees, you know, the temple was taken over by the Greeks and desecrated, but then they kind of re-established it, rededicated it. So they're in the Second Temple era. And it's Judaism at this point is more of a way of life than a set of doctrines. There's no single interpretation demanded in regard to doctrine, not like the magisterium of the Catholic Church. And because of that, when there's deviation in terms of lifestyle, that's a big deal, okay? Because doctrine is kind of back and forth, but lifestyle is a big deal. That's why the laws, the eating, the washing, the rituals, the snacking on the Sabbath, the working a miracle on the Sabbath, the touching a prostitute, you know, whatever. These are all huge deal things because that's kind of a thing that all Jews agreed on. Well, you know, Sadducees and Pharisees. Pharisees were the most to the letter of the law. The Jews are also united in their history of the exile, the law and the covenant, being set apart, being monotheistic, looking for a savior, all of that they kind of all agreed on in general. There was also, at this Second Temple period time, during the time of Jesus, there was a messianic fervor, okay? There was this expectation that a Messiah would come because of Daniel. Daniel had this prophecy that the Messiah would come in 490 years from him. And right around 490 years later, here comes Jesus. So there's this widespread belief that the Messiah would come at some point. This is why we see, like, at the beginning of Luke, the prophetess Anna and the prophet Simeon are in the temple actively looking for the Messiah because they think that he's coming anytime. And he is. Okay. Many expected the Savior to free them from Roman oppression, as we talked about earlier, to restore the promised land, to restore temple worship to them. But of course, Jesus doesn't do that. Within the Second Temple religion, there's also the development of the synagogue. Okay, a synagogue is like a local place to hear the word and to be taught the word. It rose kind of in replacement or like a pivot from temple worship during the exile. Synagogues didn't exist before the exile. They didn't need them. They had the temple. But it was like a synagogue was necessary because suddenly they didn't have the temple. And then they just kept it after the reestablishment of the temple. The synagogue served as like a school and a court and social interaction place, politics and funerals and meetings and a place of worship. It was kind of everything rolled into one. So you see that Jesus goes into synagogues as well as he goes into the temple. Christians at the beginning of the Acts of the Apostles, they preached in the synagogues until they were no longer allowed to, but it just made sense because that's where people gathered to learn and to hear. There's also something called a Targum, T-A-R-G-U-M. This is an Aramaic translation of the Old Testament. Ezra, the prophet in the book of Ezra, he spent a lot of time trying to teach the people the law again, to remember who they are as Jews. So around that time, they started developing these Targums. And the Targums are, they're Aramaic translations of the Old Testament books, but they also have commentary and paraphrase and grammatical points. It's like the teacher's notes on the actual writing. Okay, so we have some of these Targums, and Jesus used some of them, but just to let you know, Targums are a thing, as well as just another vocab word for you, the Septuagint. The Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. This was developed about 100 years before Jesus because, of course, they were conquered by Greece. So this does include the Deuterocanonical books, those seven books that are questionable that the Protestants do not have in their Bibles that Catholics do. The Septuagint does have all those books included in it, which is where the early church drew from. Okay, so the things that united the Jews, like I said, lifestyle practices, the Sabbath, the temple. The temple was big, 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 because Gentiles not permitted in the temple. This was just a Jewish thing. Romans couldn't come into the temple, okay? To speak against the temple was like to speak against God, which is why Jesus was in huge trouble when he did stuff like that. And then we've got another page here in a couple of lessons that shows you the temple and shows you kind of the ins and outs, and there's all sorts of parts of it. And it's cool to see where Jesus actually was. Lastly, on this page, let's talk about the religious groups. Okay, so in Second Temple Judaism, there developed the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Zealots, the Essenes, and we'll also talk about the Samaritans. Okay, so you have, I'm sure, heard Pharisees and Sadducees, but the thing is, they're not the same thing. And when you understand which one is which, then hearing their interactions with Jesus makes a lot more sense. They are both priests, but they're different. They dress differently, they believe different things, and they don't get along with one another. They both think that they're the right one. And so the Sadducees and the Pharisees work together to kill Jesus, but each one of them wants him gone kind of for their own reasons. So let's start with the Pharisees. I mentioned earlier that the Hasmoneans did not put the rightful priest as the high priest. They let Rome and Greece influence it. They chose to be the high priests. They kind of pawned off the role of high priest instead of being a role that was given to Aaron and to his lineage as something that anybody could take. So the Pharisees in particular were really bothered by this. As a matter of fact, this is kind of the establishment of the Pharisees. They rose up to respond to that and to say, well, we're going to be a sect of priests. We're going to be people who are separated and holy. Pharisee literally means like separated ones in Aramaic. They tried to fill the gap and distrusting the false king and the false priest they put on the throne. They said, we'll be the true, the purebreds, the right ones. Okay. They kept an oral tradition. They wrote that down as the Mishnah. The oral tradition generally wrote down in a collection called the Mishnah. They kept the law. They tended towards legalism, but they were really, you know, at the best of times, were trying to separate themselves from Greece and separate themselves from the Sadducees, who were doing the wrong thing in their lens. So the Pharisees were like, this is the law. This is the problem. We're supposed to keep this. We're supposed to do exactly this one. So they are very, very, you know, they come across as legalistic, judgmental, unable to actually love God because they're just so focused on the rules. You know, that's how they come across when they're talking to Jesus. Paul, St. Paul, was a Pharisee, okay? The Sadducees were like highfalutin priests, okay? Think of the Pharisees as like the blue-collar workers and the Sadducees as like the white-collar workers. The Sadducees were the imposter priests. They supported the Hasmoneans. They supported the Greeks. They supported the Romans. They received political power and clout from kind of bending on their own practices to say, oh, that's fine. They were like the priest that the politician keeps in his pocket, okay? They rejected almost anything pious, and pious Jews and Pharisees believed. Many of the chief priests come from the Sadducees. Chief priests are the ones who, like, lead. Okay, so Annas and Caiaphas, they are Sadducees. They are high up. They wear more fancy clothes, okay? And the Pharisees hate them because the Pharisees see themselves as the solution to the problem of the Sadducees. When the temple falls in 70 AD, Sadducees basically disappear. There's no need for them if they don't have the temple. Now, when we're talking about Pharisees and Sadducees, let's define one more word here, the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was just the ruling leadership of the Jews. It's made up of Pharisees and Sadducees and other scribes and other people, okay? But they did work together in that way, but they did not get along. One group believed in the resurrection, the other didn't. I don't remember which one's which at this point, but like they had different opinions about things. Anyway, so there's political tension and division within the Jewish people. They both consider themselves Jews, but they're not acting the same way at all. Then there's the Essenes. The Essenes are called the pious ones in Aramaic. There's only about 4,000 of them, okay, so a small sect. And after the Maccabean revolt, and after, you know, the Hasmoneans started to, you know, put the wrong priest in power, not give the power back to the Davidic king, and start to kind of become Greek and really let their Judaism slide, the Essenes said, we're out of here. We're not gonna play ball with them like the Sadducees, and we're not gonna, you know, hold the line legally like these Pharisees, we're going to disappear. So they run out into the desert and they really have their own community in the desert. And they're anti-temple. They're very devout. They're very aesthetic. Not aesthetic, like beautiful, like ascetic. Like they fast and they eat bugs. Like John the Baptist might have been an Essene, even though there is no real evidence towards it, except for the fact that, you know, he lived in the desert and ate bugs and, you know, kind of was the Essene vibe. But these guys are never mentioned by name in the New Testament. We know about them because we know about them from the Jewish history. They also are probably the ones who kept hidden the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were discovered, I think, in the 1800s or the 1900s. They kept these and they kept them safe in caves, okay? They settled in the desert, like I said. Okay, and then another group here is the Zealots. So we talked about kind of the Essenes, the Sadducees, and the Pharisees. Those guys mostly kind of like built off of each other because they're all trying to take the role of, you know, doing the right thing. The Zealots are kind of not religious leaders. They're patriots, okay? They are a sect of Jews, but they're not like priests. They're not really involved in the temple. They think violence is the answer. They want Maccabean Revolt Part 2. And they, for the sake of protecting their faith and doing what they think is the right thing, are ready to assassinate people, get people out of the way, use violence. Jesus calls a zealot to be part of his group, his followers, Simon. So, yeah, it's crazy. Such a different opinion than the rest of the Jews. Lastly, we'll talk about the Samaritans. The Samaritans were obviously from Samaria. And Samaria, if you look at the map on page 7, it's the big old red country that's kind of in the middle of Judea and Galilee. So Judea is in the green at the bottom of the map, is where most of the Jews live. This is the land that was free during, you know, the Maccabean Revolt. It's got the temple, it's got Jerusalem, it's got Bethlehem. But Galilee up north is also Jewish. They just call them the Gentile of the Jews because they're up north. Perea also is slightly Jewish. Decapolis is not, and Samaria is definitely not. Once upon a time, all this together, Galilee, Samaria, and Judea, this was all the promised land. Solomon ruled this whole land. So did David. But Samaria was taken over by the Assyrians in the great, you know, deportation, the exile, and they were scattered. Like, the people were really just indoctrinated into a bunch of different religions. And so they have five false gods mixed throughout their kind of teachings. This is what Jesus talks about when he talks to the Samaritan woman in John 4. He talks about the fact that she's got five husbands. Well, the five husbands actually are representing five false idols that are kind of brought into the culture. It's Jewish plus idolatry. So they consider themselves monotheistic. They worship God. They say they do on Mount Gerizim. But there's such tension between them and the people of Galilee and Judea that they often don't trade together. They don't communicate together. They don't even let each other walk through each other's land. Jesus is denied entry into Samaria at one point during his ministry. They're seen by the Jews as like, you're not Jewish. You're like interbred with other people. You're horrible. They were denied helping rebuild the temple back in the time of Ezra. So there's bad blood. The Hasmoneans attacked Samaria, so there's bad blood there. The Samaritans defiled the temple with corpses and killed Jewish pilgrims, so there's lots of tension and stuff. So when Jesus gives a parable about the good Samaritan, people are like, what? It's like the good Nazi, okay? It is like bad. You think, how would he ever want to be involved with Samaria, okay? And then when he goes to Samaria and talks to a Samaritan woman, she's so shocked. She's like, why are you talking to me? Because they're enemies. But Jesus is saying, I want you in the church. I want all of you. He spreads the gospel to, he tells his apostles they're going to spread it to Judea, to Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. So they do that. But okay, so that was a lot of information. I hope that gave you a little bit of a backdrop. I'll add one just fun fact going on here. The Olympics are going strong during this time of the world. They started in Greece in the 700s BC. Okay, so if Jesus wanted to, he could have popped on over and watched the Olympic Games, which I think is crazy. But yeah, that's a picture of kind of the world, at least the world of that Jesus is about to enter into. It's the Roman Empire. It's this, you know, messy little Judea that has interspersed sects of people who don't like each other, and they don't even like each other in their own religion, and they don't like people outside their religion. And then Jesus comes in and he's about to shake everything up. Okay, I will see you on the next page.